cutting-edge conversations with the quant community.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Quantcast, the Risk.net podcast on quant finance. I'm Mauro Cesa, quant finance editor of Risk.net, and in this episode I'm talking to Georgios Koufias, cross-asset quant analyst at Bloomberg in London. Georgios, thank you very much for joining us and welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much, Mauro, for the invitation. A pleasure to be here.
The idea of this podcast comes from the paper you published with us in February, Sabre Model Convexity Adjustment for Arithmetic Average Risk-Free Rate Swap. As the long headline suggests, this paper gives us the input to talk about several big topics: the LIBOR reform, interest rate swaps, convexity adjustments, and the Sabre Model. So I'd like to spend a minute to contextualize this work as it addresses an issue that comes up with the benchmark rate reform. Can we briefly summarize how the new benchmark rates work?
Sure. I think the best way to understand how they work is to compare the old regime, namely the LIBOR forward-looking rates, with the new regime, the risk-free rates. So LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, is what we call a forward-looking rate. So the characteristic of LIBOR is that it represents interbank borrowing over a term period. But the interest rate that applies over that term period is set at the front of the period. In other words, if you're going to borrow over a three-month period, then the interest rate for borrowing is known right at the start of the period. And of course, that's something that's very advantageous for, you know, budgeting and things like that. In the case of RFR, what we have is the exact opposite. You don't know the interest rate until you get to the end of the period. So we call that a backward-looking rate. But there's also another characteristic of the RFR that we also have to mention, and that is that it is a risk-free rate, as opposed to LIBOR, which is not a risk-free rate. So LIBOR is a credit-sensitive index. In other words, if you take, for instance, a three-month LIBOR and invest your money and then roll over that investment again for another 3 months, that's not the same as one single investment over the six-month period. Whereas in the case of a risk-free rate, you have a credit insensitive index. So 3 month then rolled again to become another 3 month is the same as a six-month single investment. In the case of LIBOR, what happened was that the actual interbank borrowing actually dried up. So the number of trades which were used to fix the LIBOR rate became less and less. So they became dependent on what was known as expert judgment. As a result, we all know the problems associated with that. So there was a movement away from LIBOR that we've seen now to move to risk-free rates, which are actually backed by actual market transactions. For instance, in the case of SOFA, the secured overnight financing rate in the dollar market, it's a repo transaction, and there are actually visible transactions which support the index. So that gives you a background as to where we are today.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the derivatives market is now based on that. So swaps are based on RFRs, and there's one particular type, or maybe you will correct me on this, it's not a particular type, it's just a convention, but the one that is dealt with in your paper is the arithmetic average RFR swap. Can you explain to us how it works and why this convention is in place?
It's very interesting. The arithmetic average RFR convention has actually been around for a while. Prior to the transition to RFR, and in particular, let me focus on the dollar market, the place of SOFA was used, or rather taken, by Fed funds rate. And in order to construct a dollar yield curve in the US dollar market, you needed to strip LIBOR and Fed funds instruments. Now, the Fed funds calibration was done through a basis swap in which one side was US dollar 3 month LIBOR and the other side was Fed funds basis plus a basis adjustment. And that Fed funds was not a overnight compounded rate, which is the correct way, but in fact a arithmetic average rate. So it's been around for a while. Now, what is the appeal of the arithmetic average relative to the canonical, let's say the correct way of doing an overnight compounding, which gives you the correct economic value? Well, the appeal is that it's an intuitive rate, specifically for corporates. And in fact, if you read the user's guide to SOFA that has been written by the ARRC, the Alternative Reference Rates Committee, they actually state that average rate, arithmetic average RFR convention is quite intuitively appealing, and they actually sanction its use. So the regulator actually approves it. Now, what that means is that end users have the choice to use the canonical convention, which is daily compounded over the period, or the arithmetic RFR convention. It's up to the user in the end.
In terms of volume, how do they compare?
Well, obviously the daily compounded, the canonical convention, the one that gives you the correct economic value, is the one that's traded most often in the interbank market. So that would be by far the one that is the most frequently used. But having said that, the one-month SOFA futures market settles against an arithmetic average convention as opposed to the three-month market, which settles against a daily compounded. So it is something that's embedded in the market, and you know, it's something that users need to come to terms with, and most desks would need to handle both conventions in their pricing.
And handling those conventions in the pricing means accounting for the adjustment, the convexity adjustment that is needed to make the two comparable.
Very, very salient question. In fact, your last point, making the two comparable, is in fact the whole essence of my paper. But perhaps for me to have a window into answering your question, let me talk about why the convexity adjustment actually exists. And it's interesting what the sign of the convexity adjustment is after that. And I think that will give us a nice intuitive opening into a wider discussion. So if we compare the canonical convention, I'll always use that word canonical, meaning the correct convention. So the correct convention is daily compounded overnight average. So a rate fixes for an overnight period, you compound, you do the same thing all the way through the term period. Let's say it's 1 year, you do all the 1 year fixings over the respective business days. And then you pay the compounded amount at the end of the period. Actually, there's a convention in the market where you don't actually pay right at the end of the period. In fact, there's a slight delay at the end, a 1 or 2 business days, to give back office the opportunity to calculate all the payments and settle correctly. But let's say it's right at the end of the period. So the salient point there is that each of the fixings are then compounded up. So that gives you the correct economic value. But in the case of the average RFR, you don't get that compounding effect. Once a rate fixes, that's it. It never gets a compounding effect afterwards. So a swap which is involving an average RFR convention, let's say a pay fixed and a receive floating, that has to be adjusted in its valuation for missing out those compounding effects. So in fact, you get a convexity adjustment, but the convexity adjustment is a negative convexity adjustment, slightly different to the normal type of convexity adjustment that you're used to. For instance, you may have done interviews here and podcasts to talk about CMS convexity adjustments, I'm sure, in the past.
We did, yeah.
Yes. You're probably used to hearing about positive adjustments there, where you have the naive value and then you add a particular value over that. So in fact, it's not really a convexity adjustment in this case. It's really a concavity adjustment for the a negative second derivative, but everyone in the market refers to it as a convexity adjustment. So because you're missing out on this compounding effect, it's actually an adjustment downwards to the naive rate that you would just calculate just by using the yield curve as such. But what's really important is to understand how the convexity adjustment scales with time. That's very, very significant. By that I mean, suppose that you have an interest rate swap and you look at a particular period, a particular swaplet of the interest rate swap. Let's say that that particular period is, say, a one-year period. Now, in an average rate RFR swap, that convexity adjustment for a 1 year is going to be roughly 2 times the convexity adjustment for the same swap if you have a 6 month period. Why? Because on average, you're missing out more and more interest over the 1 year relative to the 6 month. So what's important here in the average rate RFR swap is the length of the compounding period. There's a role played by where the compounding period actually starts, but not as big effect as the actual accrual period. And it's quite a nice result. I wasn't aware of that.
Because I guess the gap also compounds.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yes, yes.
Right, so this effect, you gave an idea of how much it increases over time and with time and tenors, but how big is it?
That's a very, very good question. In the past, let's say when convexity adjustments were looked at in, say, early 2010, there's a very nice paper by Takada who looks at this convexity adjustment effect in relation to the average rate RFR swaps in the Fed funds market that I spoke about. At the time, liquidity was not concentrated specifically in the RFR market. Mm. But now that we've transitioned away from LIBOR specifically to an RFR market, let's say SOFR market, that has meant that spreads have come in, they've tightened. So now the convexity adjustment is actually quite meaningful. A convexity adjustment for a 30-year average rate RFR swap with the market standard one-year frequency is roughly around -2 basis points. Now, if you compare that with the bid-ask spread, the bid-ask spread is typically around about half a basis point. We see that it is 3-4 times mm-hmm. the value of a bid-ask spread. So now it's actually quite a meaningful number and something that can't be ignored, specifically if you're a market maker in this particular area.
And how is this normally addressed?
Well, there are, I think, 2 ways that it's normally addressed in terms of calculating the convexity adjustment. One way is to use what I call the workhorse model of the interest rate derivatives market, and you're probably smiling, you know what I mean, it's the Holl-White model. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Holl-White model has analytic tractability, so it's something that allows you to compute the convexity adjustment in a very nice way, in a closed form approach. So that's one way of computing the convexity adjustment. The second way is to be a little bit more intelligent and to recognize that the convexity adjustment is smile sensitive. In other words, it's sensitive to the caplet volatility smile. For instance, if you have a one-year RFR swap, it would be sensitive to the 1 year caplet vol over that particular period. And intelligent market players, or I shouldn't say intelligent market players, I rather should say sophisticated market players who are market making in this particular area, would try and take account of the smile sensitivity of the convexity adjustment and use the Carr-Madden replication formula. And the Carr-Madden replication formula basically does an integration over the whole, not all of the smile, but a significant part of the smile from the at-the-money to a very large strike, sometimes multiples of the at-the-money strike. But both of those have significant disadvantages, mm-hmm. may I say, and to point them out. And in relation to the Holl-White model, it is analytically tractable, of course, but the problem with Holl-White is that is not your vanilla model for your pricing. If you're using Sabre for your vanilla model, ideally you want to be able to use Sabre as much as possible for your convexity adjustments to be able to net out your risk at a portfolio level. If you use different models, then it's different to compare. It's difficult to compare risk and make an apple for apples comparison. So that's a problem with Holl-White. The problem with Carmadon replication formula is that a convexity adjustment has to be done for each of the swaplets in the actual swap. So, for instance, if I go back to the example that I spoke about previously, the 30-year average rate RFR with annual frequency, you need to compute 30 convexity adjustments on each one of the periods of the underlying swap. Now, if you imagine that you do an integration often to multiples of the at-the-money strike, you're doing lots and lots of computations. And then if you look at your risk, which is usually done by bump and reval, yep, then it's going to be very, very computationally intensive. So these are the plus and minuses for market participants using these two techniques.
Yeah, and particularly aware of the drawbacks of these approaches. You have developed your own approach. Can you describe it? Can you tell us how you came about with it and how it works?
Thank you. So the essence of the paper was to really address some of those problems, one with the whole white model, two with the Carmadon replication formula. And what I tried to do in the paper, and I hope that I've done it successfully, is to take the pluses from each and combine them into something that works. So the plus from the whole white model is the analytic tractability. The plus from the Carmadon replication formula is the fact that it takes the smile into account. So what I was aiming for, and it took me a while to get there, is to try and combine the pluses from each to arrive at something that the market, I think, would be positive about. So what I do in my particular approach is to use an approximation, but a very accurate approximation, in which I boil down the convexity adjustment to be expressed as what I call a quadratic swap. Now, that's a term which is perhaps not used frequently, so let me explain a little bit by what I mean by that.
Sure.
And what the motivation is. So let's look at the case of a typical payer swap. So a payer swap means if you enter into a payer swap, you are paying fixed and receiving floating. And mm-hmm. at the end of the period, it's a contract for difference. So you net off those particular payments. And if it's plus, you receive money. If it's negative, you pay out. If it's zero, then nothing happens. So it's just a straight out netting. In a quadratic swap, you do the netting, but the netting is squared. So that's what I mean by a quadratic swap. The netting value to the power of two. And that's what I call a quadratic swap. And I was able to do some interesting mathematics to get to that particular result. But the nice thing about it is it's very intuitive, because what you get is the value of the swap just by looking at the yield curve plus a correction that involves this quadratic swap. And it's nice that it's a quadratic swap, Maru, because we have an interest rate swap, and the convexity adjustment is itself expressed as another interest rate swap. So we're sort of like in the same family of products, and it's quite an intuitive result. So this is the essence of the paper, expressing the convexity adjustment as an adjustment to the value that you get just by looking at the yield curve, plus this additional term. It's in fact not plus, we said it's minus, but I'll speak about it as if it's a plus, that involves a quadratic swap. And the essence of the quadratic swap is the netting value to the power of two.
And so you said by building this, you combined the benefits of the first two approaches that you mentioned. How about the drawbacks? How about, for example, the computational power that is required to run this?
It's almost instantaneous. I'm able to get a closed form formula. Well, the reason why I'm able to get a closed form formula, and we can speak about this in more detail later, is that I then use the market standard Sabre model. And in the Sabre model, the value of a quadratic swap has an analytical solution. There was a very nice paper, in fact, written in Risk magazine by Pat Hagen, called An End to Replication. And I think you did a podcast with Pat on that very topic. So some very powerful insights by Pat that result. And I'm able to leverage that result and get something which is very intuitive and something that can be coded up very, very quickly. And it is not only fast and analytical, but also consistent with how the vanilla market is priced. And that gives you the very significant advantage of being able to net your risk at a portfolio level. So I'd like to humbly and politely suggest it's a win-win.
can we do a little step back on the Sabre model and just maybe summarize the principles behind the model and explain why it's so well-suited to price interest rate derivatives?
Sure. Before I answer your question, can I say that I was very fortunate in that I was able to interact with Pat Hagen in one of my previous roles, and I'm fortunate enough to write several papers with Pat on Sabre-related topics. So whilst I have this opportunity, I wanted to express my gratitude to Pat Hagen for his generosity towards me and his time. And for me, it was a very exciting time. So a great thanks to Pat Hagen and to wish him every success. It's an absolute pleasure to interact with him.
So, absolutely.
So in relation to the Sabre model, what makes it a compelling model to use in the interest rate derivatives market? Let me clarify, I think a few things around Sabre. The Sabre model versus the Sabre expansion, because mm-hmm. people often mix the two. So when we say Sabre model, we're technically referring to a coupled system of stochastic differential equations. Speaking into a microphone, it's difficult to describe stochastic differential equations, so I won't go any further.
That's probably better for the audio format. It wouldn't support that very nicely.
And just say, I'll just use probably the familiar acronym SDEs, Amaro, if you don't mind. But at a very high level, one of those SDEs, it describes the asset dynamics, and mm-hmm. usually the asset dynamics is a forward rate or a swap rate. And the second SDE in that coupled system describes the stochastic vol, and those two SDEs are coupled together. Mm. So that is the Sabre model. But what most people refer to as the Sabre model is in fact the closed form analytical solution that comes out of the SDE, and Pat Hagen's remarkable work on getting a closed form formula that describes the implied volatility in terms of the parameters that appear in the actual model. So if you look at a volatility smile and we think about how a trader would think about a volatility smile, there's really three things that are important about a volatility smile from a trader's perspective. One is the at-the-money volatility, which basically sets the outright level of the volatility smile. The second thing that a trader often looks at is what's called the skew of the volatility mm-hmm. smile, namely the slope around the at-the-money, or if you like, the difference between call and put option prices either side of the at-the-money. And the third thing that a trader likes to often look at is how steep the wings of the smile actually are. And the nice thing about the Sabre model is that there is a parameter for every one of those three salient features of the volatility smile in the actual model, and it gives a very transparent connection between the model and the actual volatility smile. So there's a parameter that sets the outright at-the-money volatility, or is rather related to it, and that's the initial value of the stochastic vol. There is a parameter for controlling the skew of the smile, and it's that correlation that I mentioned between the asset process and the stochastic vol process. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third parameter, the vol-vol, which controls the wings of the smile. There's, of course, another parameter, beta, which tunes what the model looks like in terms of one extreme. Is it going to behave like a normal model and allow negative interest rates? Or is it going to behave like a log-normal model and absorb interest rates at zero and not allow anything to pass through? But that is, I think, the reason why the model is so successful. One, it has an analytical representation, and secondly, it has a very intuitive appeal in terms of the parameters in the model and what they actually mean in relation to the volatility smile. But it's also important, I think, to take a step back here and understand what the motivation was for the actual development of the Sabre model, because I think that is also important and often overlooked. I think the motivating factor in the development of the Sabre model was to try and correct some of the dynamics associated with the local vol model. So if the local vol model is when we chop out the stochastic vol part and just look at the asset dynamics only. The problem with the local vol model is that it gave an incorrect behavior of the dynamics of the smile relative to how the smile was observed in the market empirically. What was observed in the market is that if the asset value, the at-the-money, is, say, bumped upwards, the vol smile should move in the same direction. But local vol was predicting the opposite would happen. And in fact, the motivating factor was to give you the correct dynamics of the vol smile. So not only does Sabre, I think, give you a nice intuitive representation of the volatility smile and parameterization of how the smile actually is represented, but it gives you some nice dynamics, and that's important for computing risk. So it's not just pricing, but risk, and I think that's an important aspect that's often overlooked when it comes to Sabre.
And that's why, so you explained why after more than 20 years, I believe, it's still the market standard. So it is widespread. Pretty much all the major banks have a form of the Sabre model in production, I believe.
I do believe that is the case. But where I'd like to add a caveat to that is to say that I believe, depending again on the trading activities of banks, and their market-making activities, I believe that research has been done on the Sabre expansion. And banks, particularly banks who are active in the CMS market, the constant maturity swap market, which is a very active market, specifically here in the Euro market, where French insurers, it's a popular product for French insurers, and they often are active in that market, and banks are selling CMS swaps to French insurers. CMS products are very well known to be sensitive to the volatility smile, specifically to the right wing of the volatility smile. Often if you just use the naive Sabre parameterization, often that parameterization can be a bit too rich. In other words, it predicts a higher tail on the right wing than the actual CMS market. And where I think proprietary work has been done, in other words, you have your base Sabre model and then you have these modifications, is to try and modify the behavior of Sabre at its right tail specifically to fit the CMS market. And exactly what banks are doing in this proprietary nature is, a secret. But I can say that coming back to Pat Hagen, he has a very good way of doing this in a very nice paper called Universal Smile. So if your listeners are perhaps not aware of this and would like to perhaps look at some inspiration as to what to do, as to how to, affect the tail of the volatility smile without, of course, affecting the liquid part of the smile, because that's the whole trick, right? You want to adjust the extreme right tail without distorting the behavior around the liquid part of the smile. There's a very nice way that Pat suggests in the Universal Smile paper together with his other collaborators.
Okay, fantastic. And do you think the LIBOR reform had any impact on the applicability of the Sabre model for interest rate pricing?
I believe it threw up some challenges for Sabre, and those challenges I think have been addressed in Maine. So let me answer your question in two parts and say that Sabre is used extensively in the vanilla interest rate derivatives market, and specifically, firstly, in the swaption market, and secondly, in the cap floor market. So in the swaption market, there wasn't really great changes that were necessitated in Sabre, and that is because a swap rate, an RFR swap rate, is set at the front and is known, just like a LIBOR rate. So there wasn't really great changes that were required to Sabre to accommodate the transition away from an interest rate swap referencing a LIBOR to an interest rate swap referencing an RFR, let's say, is, you know, a SOFR rate. Where the big change was required was in the cap floor market, because we suddenly now have a product which is structurally quite different to the LIBOR cap. So if we go back to the very start of our discussion, and we were speaking about the comparison between RFR and LIBOR rates, we said that a LIBOR rate was fixed at the start of the period. Mm-hmm. So what that means is, in terms of a caplet over a particular period, let's say a three-month period, you know what the fixing is at the start of the period, so you can really work out what the payoff is going to be at the end of the period. And there's no uncertainty during that period. There's no vega exposure, no volatility exposure. But in the case of the RFR market, of course, we don't know the fixing until you get to the end of the period. So what that means is that we have uncertainty as to what our payoff is going to be mm-hmm. all the way through the period. But the nice thing is that that uncertainty attenuates or decays as we move through the period and you pick up more and more fixings. So as you move through the accrual period, you are getting less and less vega exposure. Mm-hmm. But the Sabre model doesn't actually have that particular feature, because all the parameters in the Sabre model, in the classical Sabre model, are constants. So there had to be an adjustment to the Sabre model to introduce this volatility decay parameter in order to model this effect, where you go from a vega exposure and eventually get zero vega exposure right at the end of the period. So that paper, again, was published in Risk magazine, I think in 2021, by Sabre Willems, in a paper called Sabre RFR Caplets, I believe. And it's something that I use extensively in my paper as well. So in summary to your question, I think the impact on the swaption segment of the market and the use of Sabre was, I don't believe, great, but I think the impact on the cap floor market, because of the structural differences between an RFR caplet and a LIBOR caplet, necessitated the extension of Sabre to a time-dependent Sabre and this concept of effective Sabre parameters.
I see. That's interesting. And your own closed-form solution to the convexity adjustment is plugged into the Sabre model. You mentioned a part of that already, but what was that? Was there any difficulty into doing this? What are the advantages that you draw from this combination?
The groundwork had already been done for me. I just had to move towards the end goal. So, if you like, I leveraged a couple of results. One was the fact that my convexity adjustment was expressed as a quadratic swap. And in the case of the Sabre model, there was an analytic formula available for a quadratic swap in the Sabre model. The second thing is that because the convexity adjustment relies on a cap floor modeling of the Sabre process, I had to use again the concept of the extended Sabre model, the time-dependent Sabre model, and use the effective Sabre parameters that I was referring to you. And again, this had already been done for me. So in a case, it was a case of, in my situation, of synthesizing these results and bringing them together. So fortunately, these results were available to me. Otherwise, I would think still be working on the problem.
Well, and the next question is beyond the SOFR rate and what has been done in this paper. But in your view, what is left to be done in quant research in relation to the transition to RFR and benchmark rates?
I think there are two main things that I'd like to highlight, and perhaps you would like to maybe add your own opinion on this one, Mara, because some excellent work, I think, has been done in this area by some articles your colleagues have written specifically. I know I often read Helen Bartholomew's articles, who is quite an expert on this, and I must admit I'm learning like everyone else from Helen, so it's a chance for me to perhaps reciprocate and reverse the information flow. So I think that there are two things which I would like to add as to what remains to be done in the RFR market, specifically from a quant perspective. One is in the euro market. I think, as we're aware of, Euribor still exists, and it exists side by side with ESTA, the RFR index. Now, will Euribor disappear? Probably not, at least not for the foreseeable future, and there's reasons why it won't disappear easily. And that is, Euribor is linked specifically to people's mortgages in Iberia, and namely in Spain and Portugal. So we see Euribor is not used just in the professional market, but in the retail market. And when you touch the retail market, that's an altogether different political thing. So we're seeing the situation where in Euroland, which has a very sophisticated interest rate derivatives market, an RFR sitting side by side with a forward-looking rate, namely Euribor. And what we're seeing is that the ESTA part of the market is growing specifically in terms of liquidity. And it's probably we're going to reach an inflection point one day, not in the too distant future, where maybe it's 50% each in terms of liquidity or how they're transacting in the market. Once we reach that, I think, that critical mass, then people are going to start requesting derivatives associated with ESTA. The first thing will obviously be the vanilla derivatives, cap floors, swaptions, and so forth. Of course, now we have a liquid market for the construction of swaps, so you can construct a yield curve. But markets, I found, have been quite parsimonious in the volatility data that they provide. So we're probably going to get the situation where there's going to be demand, say, for ESTA derivatives, but maybe only at the money vols will be quoted for ESTA. And then the challenge is, how do you, say, manufacture a whole volatility smile for ESTA so you can mark your book on these vanilla derivatives from just a Euribor vol server? So I think that's quite a challenging problem. Namely, what quants are going to do around that particular area. Now, it's probably not an immediate problem, but although, having said that, there has been some transactions in the ESTA's swaption market, limited, but there have been a few transactions. So that's one area, I think, that's going to be quite challenging. The second area that I believe is going to be challenging is to do with term RFRs. So let me firstly set the background here, what I mean by a term RFR. Again, going back to the initial discussion that we had in relation to RFRs being a backward-looking rate and they're known only at the end of the period. What a term RFR does is to say, imagine we're at the start of the compounding period. The term RFR gives you the market's view of what the expectation of the end result is going to be. So a term RFR is a forward-looking rate like a LIBOR, but it's also a risk-free rate like a standard RFR. So it sits somewhere between a LIBOR rate and an RFR rate.
And now, they will tend to converge at the end of the period, right?
No, the term RFR is set at the front of the period, so you know everything about the rate. So it's like a LIBOR rate set at the front, and that's it. So there could be a divergence, in fact, between the actual fixings and the market's expectations, right? And there's a basis here. But the interesting thing is, if you read the history of LIBOR reform, if we say trace it back to this the famous speech by Andrew Bailey, I think, back in 2017, when he first announced his intention to to decommission LIBOR, specifically when he was the head of the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, here in the UK. Of course, now he's the governor of the Bank of England, exactly. He mentioned that he did not want to see a derivatives market on term RFRs. But there's a demand for clients for term RFRs. So maybe there's going to be some relaxation around that particular limitation. And if a term RFR derivatives market, even if in a vanilla form exists, even in the case of, say, vanilla options, that's quite a challenging problem from a quant perspective, because what you have is the RFRs, the traditional RFRs, which are setting at the end, backward-looking, and your term RFRs, which are set at the front, and that's it. So you have a nice mosaic, a rich mosaic for a quant who has to now model everything in a uniform structure, because if you model it in such a way as they become out of sync, you'll introduce an arbitrage, yeah, and your pricing is going to be out. So I think that's another interesting area. But I'm sure there are many other perspectives that people can mention at this particular point. But these are the two in particular that come to mind for me.
Interesting. And how about your own research? What are you working on, or what are you planning to work on?
I hope will be realized, is to write the sequel paper to the average rate RFR convexity adjustment paper. And that sequel paper will be around the same concept, but applied to the cap floors. In other words, an average rate RFR cap floor. I say it's the sequel paper because it's the next product that a corporate user would like to look at. But it's also related to the average rate RFR swap paper, because you're constrained from what we call corporal parity, namely longer caplet, shorter floret should give me back the swaplet. Mm. So I have to make the model consistent with what I've done already. Fortunately, I've managed to achieve that. So I have the results handwritten in my notes, and I'm in the process now of typing the paper up, and I hope to prepare it and submit it to you and Naomi at the May-June period of this particular year. I'm a bit slow, I must admit, in in transferring my handwritten notes to a typed version, because what I'd like to do in my papers is to have them what I call production ready. In other words, someone can read the paper and just go ahead and code it up without any unknown secrets. So that's what I'm aiming for, and I hope that it will be well received. I hope.
We are sure. Well, as of writing, well, we know here that it takes time. So yeah, when it happens, when it's ready, we will look forward to receiving it.
Great. Thank you, Mara, for your patience with me.
Giorgio, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been very, very interesting.
Great. Thank you again for the invitation, and to, in fact, the generosity of all your colleagues and the anonymous referees for assisting me through the whole process.
I'll pass the note along.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everybody for listening.